This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElraith.
Yeah, big winds hitting Scotland this week, which is going to affect certainly recreation. But I've been up in the hills where the snow has arrived, big time.
At long last.
And we're looking at the future of Cairngorm Mountain. A lot of differing opinion, and we'll bring you that a wee bit later in the programme.
I was right up in the far north of mainland Scotland earlier this week, and I was coming back down towards Helmsdale. Clear blue skies, the snows were just, the hills just covered in snow, just these white blocks against the sky. Fabulous to see, it's lovely.
Yeah, as I was driving up to Cairngorm, just when you pass this, just before you get to the snow gates, there's kind of some gentle slopes, and it was heaving with kids.
Yeah, it's great.
Just sledging everywhere, and it was just such a wonderful sight, because we haven't had a huge amount of snow in Scotland in recent years. But the car park was full at the bottom, the car park was full at the top, and people just getting out in the Scottish countryside. It was great.
Excellent to see. Anyway, this week past is the first week I've been back behind the wheel of a car for over a month. For those of you who've been following my blogs on the Out of Doors Facebook page and following how I've been getting on, you know it's an interesting process. It's not entirely straightforward. I have learned a lot about our transport infrastructure and some of the shortfalls of our transport infrastructure. Now, Ian Finlay is Chief Officer of Paths for All. He was talking to me about something I'd never heard of before called the transport hierarchy, and it doesn't work the way I expected. I said to him, have you noticed people changing the way they approach travel?
I have actually seen a big change, especially in the last 5 years with the increased funding that's going into active travel. I think people are now using what they call the transport hierarchy to almost decide on their travel choices. And the transport hierarchy, very simply, is, first of all, think, do you need to travel or not in the first place? Mm-hmm. And if you don't, then don't. But if you do, then walking and cycling for short journeys, public transport for slightly longer journeys, which will often include a walk or a cycle, and then only think about the private car as a last resort. And that is the big change in terms of travel behaviour, which we in Paths for All and lots of others would like to see. So what you're doing is you're actually thinking now about your travel choices. I think in the past, the car, the private car, was just the default. That's how you got about. And that's how we designed our streets. And I think things are changing in that we are now being more sophisticated and thinking about the more sustainable modes of travel. And of course, the big advantage of that is that that's helping to deal with the climate emergency which we're facing, and that the higher up the transport hierarchy we can make our travel choices, it tends to be less of an environmental footprint. So there's really important reasons why we need to think about the transport hierarchy.
It's interesting the way to a lot of people, what you've done there is you've inverted the pyramid.
Yes.
You know, because most people would put the car at the top. And public transport or walking or cycling way down at the bottom. That's when you've run out of options, essentially. But the fact is, there's not an overarching authority on this that ties it together in such a way that I can say, right, fair enough, I know if I get that train, it's going to connect with a bus at a convenient time, the far side, which will then connect with a ferry, you know, along those lines. I don't know for definite that I'm going to be able to get my bicycle onto a train.
that kind of thing. So there's still big gaps in the thinking.
There is still a need for more integration between the different travel modes. I agree. I mean, there is an overall authority. I mean, it's called Transport Scotland. Mm-hmm. And Transport Scotland is just about to publish the National Transport Strategy. And one of the key strands of that is going to be looking at how we integrate better different modes of travel. Because you're right, at the moment it can be a bit disconnected. There's lots of great examples where it is connected, but overall, if you look at the nationwide, I think that is one of the priorities, is to make sure that the different modes of travel are more integrated. Now, we're interested in that Path for All, because we've just done a survey recently which showed that about 50% of adults and 75% of young people mm-hmm. walk as part of a bus journey. Mm-hmm. So bus travel doesn't only take you up the transport hierarchy and give you a lower carbon footprint, it's also really good for you because it's encouraging you to be more physically active. And that's why Path for All is so interested in sustainable travel as well as active travel, because we know for a fact that the majority of people who take a bus also walk. Mm-hmm. And so it's that level of integration as well. We need to make sure that bus and train travel is delightful, really, that people want to do it, and there's nice walking or cycling routes mm-hmm. to and from bus nodes and travel nodes, that they can do integrated ticketing and all of this. So you're right. I mean, there is a lot of work still to be done, but I think, to be fair, in Transport Scotland and on people working in this sector, we're very aware of that, and there are moves afoot to try and make it more integrated.
The idea of making it delightful is a wonderful aspiration, but I would say, from the past few weeks' experience, we're a fair distance off it, certainly from my perspective in rural Aberdeenshire. What needs to be done? I mean, Transport Scotland might be an advisory body. Do they need to have teeth? Do they need to be able to say to the bus company, sorry, you need to tie in your service with that, or the train companies or whatever? Because all of these are private, individual, commercial companies. None of this is nationalised.
Transport Scotland's an agency, so it's an agency of government charged with transport. There is the Transport Act that was passed quite recently, the Transport Scotland Act, and quite a lot of that does focus on public transport and especially buses and trying to reverse the decrease in bus patronage. And you might have picked up in programme for government recently an extra £500 million, £500 million, for bus travel. So I think Scotland is on the case that, yes, it's not ideal. And you know, I couldn't disagree with what you're saying. I live in a rural area as well, and it isn't very joined up.
And it's expensive. We're on the case. Yeah, well, I took a bus up to see a friend of mine the other day. It was a round trip of 26 miles. It cost me £14.
We are pushing for decreasing the cost of public transport because we really do have to do everything to make it as convenient and the natural choice to move up this transport hierarchy, to leave the private car behind and walk and cycle for everyday short journeys, bus and train for longer journeys. And part of that is cost. So, yes, I think serious thought needs to be put into reversing the situation where we've got at the moment, where the cost of using a private motor car has gone down over time, if you look at the statistics, whereas the cost of public transport has gone up. Now, that isn't right. We need to reverse that. The private car gradually needs to increase in cost per mile, and at the same time, public transport and walking and cycling need to decrease. And that is one of the ways in which we will change behaviour.
Ian Finlay, a Path for All there.
So much to do, so much to change.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the interesting things that has cropped out of High Speed 2, the authorisation, is that because of the Barnett consequentials and because of the devolution works, it means a lot of money becoming Scotland's way as the result of the investment in England. Mm-hmm. There are people in the Central Belt saying, it's great, we can improve the rail infrastructure. I'm just putting it out there that perhaps there's other projects in rural Scotland that could transform people's lives. I was speaking to a lady in Dufton who said, I can go to Elgin for my shopping, but I can't get back the same day.
Yeah.
There's a lot of real hardship in rural Scotland, and if there's that much money coming, let's make it all free.
Well, that's actually a very solid argument, I would have thought. You know, because I can understand people in the Central Belt saying our system is not perfect.
But for a lot of people in rural Scotland, they're saying our system isn't.
It isn't.
It just simply doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist. Yeah. As I said the other week, there was a chap who's going to college in Inverness, and he was paying £17 a day on the bus.
Yeah.
There's got to be something wrong there.
Yeah, absolutely nuts. The future of the Cairngorms Mountain is a subject we've kept tabs on since the funicular closed. And then the operating company of the funicular disappeared, basically. It's a situation where just about everybody's got a view. Some folk want a community buyout or some sort of asset transfer. Others would like to see the funicular repaired, while others still would like to see it removed completely. And there are many who want restrictions on where folk who use the railway can go, just to be ripped up and thrown away.
Yeah, because there's a strange anomaly at the moment. When the funicular railway was put in, there was a restriction that you could get out at the top, but you couldn't access the Cairngorm Plateau because they were worried the numbers would be too big and the impact would be too much. Others say this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It'll access the Cairngorm Plateau for elderly people, people who are struggling a wee bit, and they could enjoy it as well. There's arguments both sides. But HIE, who own the mountain, are holding a series of consultations to see which of the options are most popular. And the man behind that is Dave McLeod.
With regard to the funicular project, the design team and the project management team are continuing to work very hard on the solutions. We are engaging with the statutory consultees, Cairngorm National Park Authority, Highland Council, Scottish Natural Heritage, and we're doing everything we can to work towards an early planning application for the works that are required, and we're hoping to submit that in the next few weeks.
What about the funding for it? Is the Scottish Government going to pay for it?
There are discussions ongoing between HIE and the Scottish Government at present, which involves the outline business case that's being prepared at the moment, and those discussions will continue in terms of trying to find a solution in terms of the funding.
Any idea kind of timeline? Because I've spoken to a lot of people who are really frustrated at the seeming slowness of the whole process.
The engineering situation with the funicular has been complex. There's a lot to think about in terms of both the engineering, the ecology, the environment, the planning implications. None of these things can happen quickly. We're doing everything we can to expedite matters, so I think people have to understand that we are in a statutory process. We've got a safety case to deliver for the Department for Transport before the funicular can be reopened. That's a statutory process, so we are being governed by the processes that we have to follow.
You've got a series of consultations going on throughout the area at the moment. What are you hoping to achieve by that?
The master plan is a really important part of the work we're doing at the moment in Cairngorm. The community engagement is fundamental to that. We are looking to be as transparent as possible in terms of collecting people's views. We want to hear from people with all sorts of views in Cairngorm. It's important that we gather that intelligence. We appreciate that lots of different people have got very different views on Cairngorm, but it's important that the master planning team gather those views, both from the community, from stakeholders, from users of the mountain who are, come in very, very, very different guises. And we're trying to feed in to develop a vision for the future of Cairngorm that the majority of people can buy into.
You're running this at arm's length by a consultation company. Why is that? Why are you not doing it?
We're trying to make it sure that people understand that we are trying to be as transparent as possible, that we're not trying to influence what the feedback might be, and we're wanting to gather all views. And we just felt it was appropriate for us to step back from that and allow the community and the stakeholders to have a very clear engagement route with the consultants.
One of the things that's been bandied about, that it was a ridiculous situation where you could go up the funicular but you couldn't get out onto the wider Cairngorms. Is that up for discussion?
I think one of the things we've been made very clear in terms of the consultation process is that everything is open for discussion. I think it's also very important to emphasise that the Section 50 agreement, which regulates access from the funicular, is a very important document. It's there to protect the environment, which is very important to ourselves and a lot of other people. But we don't want to rule anything out. We're wanting honest, transparent feedback.
What about the situation with the request for an asset transfer by the community? There's been a lot of talk about it. Have you had a formal application yet?
No, we have not had a formal application from the community. One of the teams in HIE continues to do a lot of work with the community, but there's been no application as yet.
Will you support it? Because you're in this really odd situation, aren't you, where you own it and you would have to help them make that transfer.
I think until we see what the application would look like, I think it's difficult to make a view on that, to be quite honest.
Do you think you're going to end up in a happy state the people, everybody happy with the outcome on it. Because yeah, it's such a vital part of the local community.
I think we have to be realistic and acknowledge that you will find it difficult to find any situation like this where everybody's happy. We're trying to gain consensus. We're trying to be transparent and collect views. But ultimately, decisions will be made that some people will be happy with and others won't. And, you know, that's just a fact of life.
That's an obvious question, but how committed are you to sorting this whole thing out?
We're incredibly committed to sorting this out. It's a huge asset for the local area. It's a really important asset for Scotland. There's a large variety of people who enjoy the Cairngorms, love the Cairngorms, and what we're trying to capture is their interest in the future. So we are absolutely dedicated to finding the right solution.
What about the staff who are on the mountain? They've had a pretty torrid time of it during this whole process.
The staff at Cairngorm continue to do an extraordinary job. People who know the environment, as beautiful as it is, it's a really brutal environment. They pull out all the stops in order to make sure that snow sports are available, and clearly the conditions at the moment look really, really promising for the half-term holiday, so we're hoping that as many people as possible will get out and enjoy the mountain.
There's been a lot of relieved people up there now. Snow at last.
Yeah, absolutely. We've all been praying for it. It's come. Let's make sure people get out there and enjoy it. But yeah, we have to acknowledge the efforts of the staff. They do a fantastic job.
Dave McLeod there of Highlands and Islands Enterprise.
Yeah, interesting discussions though.
The trouble is there's an awful lot of options. An awful lot of options. And given the past record of that entire area, understandably, they want to get it right, and they are also hemmed in to a certain extent by rules and regulations. They have to do it by the board.
Yeah, and it's interesting because they don't have the money to repair the funicular. That would presumably have to go to government. But it's early days in the consultation. Mm-hmm. But one of the meetings took place on Thursday up on Cairngorm Mountain, so I went up there and spoke to some of the folk enjoying the hill and got their thoughts on what they want to happen next. Excuse me.
Hey there.
I'm from BBC Scotland.
Yeah.
Highlands and Islands Enterprise are consulting about the future use of this mountain. How do you feel about that? Should we keep the funicular? Should we get rid of it? Should we develop it?
I think we should keep it. Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on... Certainly it depends on the winters we get. But if you use it properly and keep respecting the fact that there's, you know, there's lots of flora and fauna around that you look after the slopes, why not?
Do you think people should be allowed to walk away from the top of the funicular?
No.
You know, open up the access?
No. Turns into a tourist attraction, attracting the wrong people. So it's all about respecting the mountain. So, yeah, people want to get up there then. Yeah, use your legs.
I'm from BBC Scotland. Oh. Highlands and Islands Enterprise are consulting this week about the future of the mountain.
Uh-huh.
What do you think about that?
I'm hoping that it's going to be very open, because from what I've heard, there's been lots of behind-the-scenes things happening in the story so far, so it would be good to know everything that's happening and all the discussions that are going on.
Loads of snow today. What do you think about the future of the funicular? Do you think it should be repaired or should you get rid of it?
Well, they've already got rid of the other toes that would have rescued it, so I think they're going to have to repair it, otherwise the mountain's done for. They have to repair it.
What about you? There's a process at the moment where the community would really like an asset transfer to take control. What's your thoughts on that?
I think ownership within the community is usually very positive, bound to get the priorities straight, and that it's here for the community and here for the people and not for business and big business filtering the funds off. So,
but there is a lot of demand. I mean, looking around, there is snow and the place is absolutely full.
It's great. We skinned up to the ptarmigan there, and it's a beautiful asset up there that's totally empty. So we need to get people up there again and start using it.
What about you on the funicular? Keep it or get rid of it?
I actually don't know the funds of it. If it's fixable, I would keep it. It seems, but I don't know how expensive it is to fix versus how expensive it is to replace it.
Well, enjoy your day on the hill.
Thanks very much.
Cheers. I'm from BBC Scotland, and I'm just asking a few folk what they think. Highlands and Islands Enterprise are consulting about the future use of this mountain. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't know. It's hard, isn't it? Nobody really knows what's going to happen with the climate. That's the problem.
Well, here we have snow today, which was a month ago you wouldn't have thought possible.
Exactly.
What about the funicular? Do you think you should repair it or get rid of it?
I'd like to see them repair it, I must admit. It seems a bit of a waste. I know it's very controversial. And again, nobody knows. That's the problem. Don't know what the future holds. You know, I bought a season pass. Haven't been able to use it yet.
Get
same
up to
last
day.
Year.
Get up to
I'm day. Going to Skeezer in the back of the car.
Enjoy your day.
Had to go to Italy last week to get some skiing, so...
Well, we'll be good today.
Nice.
See you later.
Skiers taking advantage of the snow at Cairngorm this week.
And obviously with a lovely lady, because she was just parting. She said, you know, I love waking up with you and Mark every Saturday morning.
In a manner of speaking.
It was yes. Lovely. No, but so many folk came up and said, just thank you. Yeah. What makes it worthwhile?
Yeah, well... A couple of weeks ago, I was down in Stirling, visited a place called The Engine Shed. It's run by Historic Environment Scotland. It's actually part of their building conservation centre. And we were talking then about an exhibition which is on at The Engine Shed called Nation of Stone, which is really worth a look-see. Whilst I was there, I also took the opportunity to have a word with stonemason Chuck Jones on the skills that are required just to carry out that kind of work.
For stonemasonry, you know, myself, I was always quite keen in art, technical drawing, attention to detail, you know, all that sort of stuff I quite enjoyed when I was at school. And if that's something that you like and something that you're particularly good at, then those skills will certainly serve you well when you go on to become a stonemason.
Can you spot a good potential recruit when they walk in?
We can. You know, I used to work at the Stonemasonry Training Centre for Historic Environment Scotland, and it's actually the employers that take on the apprentice, and then it's the apprentice that gets sent to college by the employer. So we actually don't know what they're like until the first week. And, you know, by the end of the first week, you know, we know the ones that are going to take less work on behalf of the tutor, and we know the ones that are going to take more work from us. So it's you do get a whole range of different people in there. But, yeah, you're right. Some people just have a natural ability and really excel at the craft of stonemasonry.
Somebody that's really got a good eye.
Yeah, 100%. If you've got a good eye, you know, you almost want to see the finished result before you've even started. Yeah. And that is a skill in itself.
Yeah, it's interesting. Is there a sort of age range for this?
A lot of people believe that, you know, apprenticeships, they just start when you're 16. You could just come straight out of school, drop into apprenticeship, and you can. But, you know, the last intake that we had at the college for stonemasonry, we had apprentices from 16 to 52.
Does it tend to be quite a male-dominated thing?
It has been male-dominated for a lot of years. You know, there was a lot of manual and heavy lifting involved. But in this day and age, you know, those risks, you may want to call them, have all been eliminated because, you know, health and safety regulations these days sort of dictate that nobody can lift over a certain weight, and there's lots of mechanical and lifting aids that we all have to use now. So I would say that the idea that you will have to lift heavy stuff, you know, you should ignore that because it certainly isn't the case nowadays.
Yeah. How about how you actually work the stone? Because I'm sure there's technology that exists that, you know, you can more or less, almost like AutoCAD, program it in and something will carve it into the right shape for you.
There is. There's a lot of technology developing. There's a lot of good stuff coming forward. But, you know, you just can't quite replicate a hand-finished piece of stone.
Yeah. And you know, why does that make a difference, though?
If everything is just generated or made by computer, or, you know, everything becomes the same. You know, I could look at a piece of stone, two different stones, and know that there was two different stonemasons have produced it. You know, that there's almost an art and a skill and a beauty in seeing a stone that's been worked by hand. And I can often see how that person's worked that stone, where they started and where they finished. You know, and it's character, really. And a good stonemason will work just as quick as a piece of machinery.
The type of stone that you're actually using, does it have, or I'm assuming it must have, different characteristics? You know, do people instinctively read those characteristics? Is it something you learn or what?
They do. You know, there are soft and hard stones, medium density stones. And, you know, you sometimes never know what the... You know, I could work a piece of stone from a certain quarry 5 years ago and then start another project and get the same stone, and it could be a different texture altogether because, you know, they may have went deeper in the quarry, slightly more to the left or right, and, you know, it's a natural product, so you do get the variety and change in the material itself.
My local town is Inverurie in Aberdeenshire, and they used to have a collection, I think, of about 4 or 5 of those carved stone balls. They're about the size of cricket balls.
Yeah.
Every time I looked at one of those, I thought, how long
did it take somebody with primitive tools to do this? Because it's impossibly hard material.
It is, yeah. And it's funny you should mention that. That is actually the last stone that they cut as part of their training in stonemasonry, is a spherical ball.
Do they?
Yeah, we call it a ball finial. You know, and yeah. It is a circular ball on a pedestal. You know, over time...
How do you get it completely circular?
Well, you have a reverse template, you know, and you break the ball down into segments and quadrants, and you just... You've never got the template out of your hand. You're
so it's a bit like a bit of hardboard with the correct circle cut out of it, and you just work around and chip everything else away.
Yes, quadrant of a circle, and you're just dividing the stone up into quarters and then breaking it down even further, and you're just constantly taking a bit, checking. You know, there is a method to running around it in a sequence in which you must cut it, and once you know that, you know, I would actually say it looks really impressive when it's finished, but it actually isn't that difficult to cut. It just takes a long time.
When did you realise that you enjoyed working with stone?
Well, I wasn't sure when I left school whether I wanted to go into architecture or design of some sort, and I actually got some time working with a stonemason, with an architect's practice up in Angus, and there was a stonemason working on his estate, and it was at that time I was really inspired by what he was doing, the skills, you know, what he was producing, and purely by chance, you know, I live in quite a remote part of Angus. Historic Environment Scotland has a depot there, and they advertise for a stonemason. And it was almost like the stars had aligned for me, so to speak. But it was, you know, it was an occupation that I'd considered, but thought, I'm not going to be able to achieve this in my area. And then all of a sudden, you know, a job appears, and all the dots got lined up from that point onwards.
My line of work, we put stuff together every week, it goes out, it disappears. Your line of work, you are creating something which will last 1,000 years, potentially. I mean, do you find yourself going back to areas that you've worked on and looking at a particular block and thinking, yeah, I remember that one?
Yeah, 100%. It's, you know, it is an amazing sense of achievement. Like I say, you could be working a stone for days or weeks. And, you know, when you finish that stone, there's an element of pride in it that is going on a building and it will outlive you. And, you know, I sometimes think it's a reason that Mason's marks were put on stones, because there's a sense of achievement and they're proud that they've produced that, and they're just signing their work, really. It's a bit like an artist would sign a painting. They're putting their mark on there to say, I produced that.
Chuck Jones from Historic Environment Scotland there.
Yeah, listening to that in frustration, because I've had a go at carving stone balls. I never even thought about making a template to make it circular. You just kind of chip a bit off and it was too much, so you take another bit, so you start with a big huge ball.
You end with a chucky.
With a chucky. But you're right about the point, you know, their work lives on forever.
Yeah.
And we toss it out into the ether.
Well, ours is completely ephemeral. It comes, unless, of course, you download the Scotland Outdoors podcast.
Which is there.
Which is
forever.
Infinite and forever. You can't get rid of it.
Yep.
It's like a rash.
Tell your friends. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
On a recent visit to the Loch of Strathbeg, which is up in the northeast corner of Scotland, to celebrate World Wetlands Day, Helen Needham also discovered that otters, lovable scamps, had been helping themselves to chicks at the nature reserve. So, the RSPB decided to build a fence, with some pretty astonishing results. Here's Richard Humpage.
We've also been doing quite a bit of work here. You can see the new fence just in front of you here. This is an anti-predator fence that we're putting up to protect some of the nesting birds.
That's quite a big fence. Is that to keep deer out?
It's primarily aimed at otters, actually.
Really?
We have a smaller fence right in front of the visitor centre, which you can just see behind the trees there. And we've had tremendous success with that. Sort of 5 years ago, there was 10 pairs of terns on there. And last year, there was nearly 300.
Wow.
But the difference is that fence. And I've sat in the visitor centre and I've seen four otters at one time crisscrossing the island there looking for food. Everybody likes to see an otters. I mean, I love otters as well. But they don't just eat fish. They eat a lot of birds and bird eggs and chicks and things as well. They are quite a voracious predator. So by putting that fence up around the pool sort of 4 or 5 years ago, as I say, you know, we've tremendously increased the amount of nesting birds there. And so this year we've decided to hugely expand the area that's available and put a fence up around and almost 9 hectares of ground. So we're hoping for bigger and better things.
What is special about an anti-otter fence? Is this something that's been tried and tested elsewhere?
It is, actually. The sizes of the mesh is designed and built specifically to not allow access for otters. So an ordinary stock fence, an otter can actually fit through the holes of it or can actually climb over the top of it. Otters are very good climbers. So you'll see this fence has quite a small mesh on it, and the top of it is overhung so that the otters can't actually climb up and over the top.
I was wondering why it was that shape. Right. So they're pretty determined, clever creatures then.
They are, yeah. I mean, they're fantastic predators. Very effective at catching and eating things, yes.
They'll be across then. Where will they have gone?
Well, when we put the fence up around the small pool here, there was an otter track from the holt just around the corner there, best part of a foot wide, where the otters were just coming straight over to this island to feed. As soon as we put that fence up, that track moved and was heading straight out to the lock. So now they'll be feeding almost entirely on fish.
So they've had to change their diet as a result of your fence?
I mean, they would have been eating fish as well as the birds anyway, because the birds that were only here during the spring and summer. So the otters would have been feeding on fish largely outside of that time.
Richard Humpage at the Lock of Strathbeg.
Yeah, it's great that they've got the fence, but what a fantastic problem to have.
Uh-huh.
Because 20 years ago, everybody thought the otters were gone.
Yeah.
We'd lost them.
Yeah.
What's even more bizarre is that 30-odd years ago, you could hunt otters in Scotland. Thankfully, we got rid of that. But because of the interaction with the mink, the otter population was in real problems.
Yeah.
But they come back big time.
Somebody posted something on Twitter the other day showing otters in the harbour at Leith in Edinburgh, just playing about.
Yeah.
That's lovely to see.
I posted one the other day about an otter with the baby on its tummy, and he's lying on her back, just swimming away.
Otters Mustelidae.
Yeah,
they are. So same family as badgers and stoats and weasels and everything else and what have you. Friends of ours used to live on Isla, and they had chickens and ducks, and the otters used to go through them like a dose of salt.
Yeah, you've got to... Well,
they are predators.
Yeah, well, they will, but it's the same with pine martens, badgers, whatever. You really need to make it bomb-proof.
Mm-hmm.
And the trick I had to pass it on, I suffered from badgers taking, and possibly otters, taking hens for years. Just put the entrance up at 4 feet high, and the hens can fly up.
Because the badgers have only got little short legs.
Yeah, they can reach up to it, but they can't get it. And I was kicking myself. For 20 years, I lost birds. And then I was watching a thing like Fernley Whittingstall.
Oh, yes, Hugh Fernley Whittingstall, a well-known anagram.
You know, put the entrance up high, they can't get in. Problem solved.
Yeah, and you went, duh.
Duh. And then the pine marten arrived, and he just climbs over the fence.
Just help himself.
So now what I have is I have the fence, the door high up, Fort Knox around it, and the cage over the top.
Yes. You can buy eggs in the supermarket, you know.
It's completely... We're going off script here. There is nothing to compare.
When have we ever been off script?
A freshly laid egg with the things you buy in the supermarket,
why?
Which can be up to 3 or 4 weeks old.
You are such a food snob. You cannot be seriously saying that there's any real difference at all.
I will put it... Well, I'll bring it in next week. When you... Because the protein in the egg gets denatured over time quite quickly.
Uh-huh.
Whereas you pop a freshly laid egg in a pan of boiling water, it stays together, it's solid.
Uh-huh.
Whereas the stuff that you're buying, you have to put vinegar in, otherwise...
Well, you're talking about poaching eggs.
Yes.
Poaching eggs, right, fair enough. Because personally, I boil my eggs in the shells. I don't know about you. It doesn't really matter either way.
Yeah, it's an argument.
It is an argument. You're listening to the Scotland Outdoors Podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. He's your McElriff.
Josephine how do you pronounce that?
Batch.
Batch emailed from Germany. He said, "Dear Ewan and Mark, you're always saying how you love hearing where people are listening to your podcast." Well, we do, no matter where you are in the world, whether it's Scotland, whether it's down the road in Aberdeen, or the sunny Caribbean, wherever, we love to hear from you. She says, "I currently live in Germany, and I've got 2 weeks left to finish my master's dissertation in architecture, so I'm sitting in front of my laptop basically 24/7.
She goes on, "I really miss having time to go for long walks, especially in Scotland, but luckily I can listen to you walking around, meeting all those interesting people and watching geese to get my daily dose of nature. I discovered your podcast only recently, so I can binge listen to it every day. I will definitely keep listening to you after I've moved back to Aberdeenshire in March. Thank you for the fantastic podcast. All the best, Josephine," and thank you very much, Josephine, for getting in touch.
Yeah, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
What should we talk about next?
Let's talk about coasts.
Right, fair enough. It's been a wild week of weather, and it's a forecast to continue with Storm Dennis. Earlier this week, I took a trip to Stonehaven, not just to look at the aftermath, which was pretty startling, of Storm Ciara, but to find out quite an interesting project to monitor our ever-changing coastlines. All you need is a mobile phone and the ability to upload some photographs.
I love the sound of the sea. I grew up beside the sea. And I'm on Stonehaven Beach at the moment, just beside the River Cowie. And it's quite benign today. You know, the sun is shining, it's blue skies, there's a couple of eider ducks out there. You know, there's waves, but nothing much of one. But a couple of days ago, circumstances here were very, very different. And the local council have come up with a clever idea just to try to monitor how fast things change here.
My name's Gavin Penman. I work for Aberdeenshire Council. I'm the projects manager who deals with flooding, coastal protection, harbours, all that kind of thing.
You can see a cleaning wagon just along the road there. What are they doing?
After the storms that we've experienced over the weekend, we had quite a lot of overtopping.
What does that mean?
Basically, when the waves run up to the end of the beach and then they overtop, for example, onto the walkway there and also the promenade, we had quite a lot of seawater coming over and obviously a lot of shingle and stuff as well. So we've had to do a fair bit of cleaning up after the weekend.
We're not talking chuckies here. We're talking actually quite large bits of stone just getting picked up over the sea. And basically, the beach got picked up and dropped on the road.
Absolutely. It really demonstrates the power that the sea has. It can throw up quite a lot of large debris. I mean, fortunately, the road was closed. We took a decision to close the road for public safety reasons. I don't think there was any properties flooded, but it's a useful reminder that these things can happen.
And not to muck about. We're not actually here to talk about the overtopping, though. Explain to me what this is, because I mean, this ties into the same thing. This, what we're looking at right the way along the length of the beach, is a dynamic environment. It changes.
Absolutely. What we have here is what we call CoSNAP, which is a facility where any member of the public can come along, put their phone in a holder, they can take an image and share it onto our Facebook page. The aim is to gather as many images as we can over the long term. People taking images, sharing them with us, and it gives us an idea of what the beach is doing longer term, because it is it's a very active beach. The beach is very important in terms of flood defence. You know, it stops the waves running up and causing flooding. So we're very keen to understand how the beach changes over time and how that would then allow us to make decisions about how we manage the beach going forward.
Changes can happen here very, very quickly. I mean, just looking up the beach, ordinarily I would expect there to be a lot of sand there. Mm-hmm. Most of the sand has actually been washed away, so you're left with a heavier shingle. The shingle itself is banked right up to the seawall.
Yes.
And obviously was going right over the top of that. You're going to see some pretty spectacular changes sometimes.
Yes, it's going to be really interesting. As we've had just after a storm event, things change very quickly. And it lets us understand how the beach reacts to these type of storms. So, yes, short term, there'll be some quite significant changes that we can look at and we can track. But also longer term, you know, in terms of sediment, how sediment may move around the beach. It's quite an active bay,
yeah,
this.
Yeah,
it's very interesting.
This is one of the things for me that characterises Stonehaven. It's the beach, it's the seafront. It kind of, you know, that's what gives it its entire character.
Absolutely. There's a lot of tourists come here, not just in the summertime, you know, this time of year as well. And what we're hoping is people will see this facility, they'll take an interest. It's right in the middle of what you could call Stonehaven. You know, a lot of people walk up from the harbour area. It's quite a busy area, and we just hope that people will take a minute to look at this and maybe go onto the Facebook page and just see what it's all about.
Yeah. I'm guessing you've kept an eye on this beach for several years now. Beside the River Cowie, it floods. You know, Stonehaven has a reputation to a certain extent for flooding. Having this sort of collection of photographs, is there any possibility it could show you something surprising?
It may well. I mean, we think we've got a basic understanding of what happens to the beach here. We've done various things in the past, moving sediment from this end up to the River Carron. So I'm hoping it'll just give us a bit of a better understanding of what's happening here.
I've seen one of these, or the equivalent of these, in Cairngorms National Park. I don't think I've seen one on the coast before.
No. This is the first one in Scotland. There's one in the south of England, I think. We're very pleased that this is one of the first ones in Scotland, and hopefully there'll be a lot more up and down the coast, because I think it's a really interesting facility.
Yeah, and it's not just a PR exercise. Someone is going to be sitting and going through these photographs and trying to glean data out of them.
Absolutely. Our consultant GBA, they've got various survey points on the beach, so they can reference each photo and build it into a picture longer term, and we can see what's happening. So it's going to be interesting.
Gavin Penman of Aberdeenshire Council there. And if you are on the front at Stonehaven, it's the bit called Crow's Nest just beside the River Cowie. And it's just a little bracket. You stick your phone in there, take the photograph, and then upload it. And it will be used. I mean, there's an environmental consultant going to go through these photographs and basically, because they'll have a timeline, and actually see how the coastline actually moves and changes.
Last time I was down there, it was covered in stones and I dumped over the wall.
Yeah. Well, I mean, basically, the storms, Ciara just picked up the beach and dropped it the other side of the wall. Messy.
Ooh.
Very, very messy. Anyway, we're big fans of baths on the Scotland Outdoors podcast. In our opinion, you can't have enough of them. They keep you safe from traffic, away from exhaust fumes, and take you to interesting places. Now, an EU scheme to fund path construction has proved very popular. Animal Drysdale, its paths officer with Nature Scotland.
Well, we're seeing, of course, great demand now. More and more people want to get out into the countryside. Scottish Government is so keen for people to be doing outdoor activities for their well-being, for their physical health. So, yeah, it's becoming more and more popular.
Because we've been banging on about this for years. I wouldn't let my children ride the main roads of Scotland. It's a dangerous place. But you have to have off-road facilities.
Yes, in fact, I've just passed a group of walkers on the road as I came here today, and did feel quite bad for them, because you know how the rural roads in Scotland, traffic can hurtle past very quickly. So it'd be great to try and get more routes just off the road that connect villages, connect public transport links as well.
Now, normally you're working at the Forvey Nature Reserve. What's your job now? What are you doing?
So I've been on a really great year off from the Nature Reserve and out into the wider countryside, looking at this particular option that was available through the Scottish Rural Development Plan. It helped to fund paths in rural areas of Scotland, open to a wide range of applicants, so from community groups, local authorities, as well as landowners.
Who's funding this? That's Scottish Government funding?
Yeah, so this is Scottish Government money from the EU, delivered in partnership by Scottish Natural Heritage and the Scottish Government Rural Payments Division.
So what kind of funding is available? Is it 100% or has somebody got to meet you halfway?
Yeah, quite a good aspect of this scheme is that the fund paid for capital items. So if you wanted a certain stretch of path, there was a fixed rate for that length of path, picnic tables, signs, you knew exactly what rate was being offered and that's what you claimed at the end.
It's a wild day here. The trees are bending over. It's not the kind of day you would normally actually want to get out. But how successful has it been?
Oh, I think it's been great. IPA has now delivered over the 4 years it has.
Go and explain what IPA is.
Oh, yeah, sorry. So the Improving Public Access Option, or IPA for short, over the 4 years it has been running, has now delivered just over 100 miles of path, new path or improved path across Scotland.
The potential is massive.
Yes, I think so. And it's not even on the grand scale of the huge trails like the West Highland Way. It's the very important local links between villages or to points of interest or to public transport. So these small missing links in the path network can be filled in with the help of the Improving Public Access Scheme.
Now, you can't mention EU funding without suddenly realising we're not in the EU anymore.
Yes, so this is an exciting time for me, and I'm hoping my review of this scheme is going to help shape what comes next. So we're hoping, of course, ministers and advisors are working on the next scheme, and hopefully there'll be an announcement later this year. But we are hopeful that there will, of course, be another access fund.
So would that be from Westminster or would that be from Holyrood?
This will be from Holyrood, from Scottish ministers, Scottish Government.
Are you getting positivity coming back at you?
Absolutely, I think so. It's, of course, one of the high priorities for the Scottish Government is to encourage active travel and people getting outdoors.
Is it expensive to put a path in relative to the benefits that you get for society?
Oh, I think absolutely. It's been very, very good value for money. And if people have access, of course, their own materials on their own land, they can do it quite cost-effectively.
So farmers are getting into this?
Yes, they are. But it's, of course, this scheme was open to quite a wide range of people, from local authorities and community groups and charities, as well as landowners. Overwhelmingly, the landowner has been the biggest applicant because it's been part of the rural payment scheme. But yes, good representation from a whole range of people as well.
Presumably there needs a bit of urgency if this scheme is ceasing to be funded by the EU. Is there something potentially in place quite quickly that paths will continue to be built in Scotland?
There'll be no applications this year, 2020, but every intention that the scheme will open in some form in 2021.
It'd be great to have a path around every big farm, every big estate. And there's got to be benefits as well in terms of managing people. Yeah, we've all got the right to roam, but if you put a path in...
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we've seen some great reasons for landowners building paths, partly just to provide an experience for the local community, but also it can help to manage people around farm, keep dog walking separate from livestock, for example. So formalising a path helps people know where they are safe to go and responsible.
Animal Drysdale there, and just talking wonderful common sense, but... I thought we'd go and have a look at the scheme actually in action, and I visited a young couple in the northeast who've taken advantage of the funding, and they've built a public access path right round the farm.
I'm Helen McIntosh.
And I'm Fraser McIntosh.
And what's the name of the farm?
It's Mains of Bufflaw.
And we're standing here looking out on your brand new path.
Yes, it's brilliant. Are you enjoying it?
It's a lovely path, and it links into one I have cycled before.
Yeah, it goes round the River Yugi here and connects up to the Buchanan for Martin Way. So it's been well used so far.
So tell me about the path. What is it? How big is it? How long is it?
It's just short of 10 kilometres as a loop, and that's included some of the Buchanan for Martin Way.
And it skirts right round the edge of your fields?
Yes, it does. Yeah, you can see what we're busy doing in all the fields.
So was that intentional?
It was intentional. So it goes right round our boundary, and it's within our water margins. And so it's in an area that we have to stay away from the water courses anyway with our machinery. So it was an ideal opportunity to put that path in and let people see what we're doing.
So is this path for anybody, or is it just your personal one?
No, it's for everybody. It can be used with wheelchairs, prams, cycles, horses, foot runners.
It's a big job, though, putting in 4 kilometres of path.
Yeah, it was a big task, and we probably couldn't have got a worse autumn to try and complete the task, but it's gone well. We did a wee bit last year, and we finished it this year, and it's worked great.
What about public reaction to it?
Great, yeah. We can't believe how many people are using it and the amount of diverse people that are using it. We never imagined how many cycles would be using it, which just shows the market out there for...
Because there's an awful lack of understanding in terms of farming in the public in general. Are you seeing that as an interface?
Yes, we have a Facebook page for the path, which we try and educate people of what we're doing in the fields. They see us very busy in the fields throughout the year, and we just want to let them know what we're up to with when we're spreading fertilisers, when we're spraying, when we're combining.
But presumably there's a potential for criticism as well when they see you spraying close to the edge.
Well, absolutely. But we're arable farmers and we do spray crops, but not every time the sprayer's in a field, it's not always a chemical. You know, quite often we spray minerals and fertilisers. So it's just to let people know what we're doing. You know, and instead of just seeing a sprayer and thinking it's all bad, it's just to tell people what's happening.
But I mean, it's pretty brand new, but has it been pretty well accepted already?
Yeah, absolutely. We put in a car park alongside, which gives people space to park their cars and get their dogs and their children out of the cars safely. So I think that's really helped to get people out there and seeing this part of the countryside.
But why did you want to do it?
To improve public access.
Because a lot of farmers, that's the last thing they would want, is the public coming to the farm.
It is a little bit, but with the River Yugi and the existing for Martin Way, we always had people coming and parking their cars and trying to walk. So at least if we have a dedicated place for people to go, it's safe, and we've got a lot of heavy machinery here, so at least we know where people are.
Presumably expensive.
Yeah, it is expensive. There's a bit of funding to help with it, so that certainly worked, but... The business we're in, and we want to let people see what we're doing, so it works well.
How important is that? Because a lot of people see farming, they know nothing what's going on, but presumably if you've got nothing to hide, open the doors.
Exactly. We want to show people what we're doing and that we're not bad farmers. We are taking care of the land. We are custodians of this land, and we have to make sure that we take care of it to pass it on to future generations. But then they can also see the amazing wildlife that we have. They're getting access to the River Yugi and the Fechfield Burn, where they've never seen before, and they can see different wildlife and their habitats and how they exist.
Was part of the inspiration, for want of a better word, the fact that you do have a right-of-way passing right through your land? Presumably you used that as a child.
Yeah, absolutely. It was brilliant. We had a direct route into the local village to go and play. So we just saw how safe it was. And we've got two young kids ourselves. And it's just a good platform for them to get out on their bikes and get round and get outside, you know. So
it looks a bit hard engineering at the moment. You know, I'm not seeing it at its best. It's a wild, horrible day. It looks, it kind of sticks out. Is that going to change over the summer?
Of course it will, yeah. We'll get all the growth back up come spring, and you'll be able to enjoy it for what it's worth. It is quite hard just now.
Are you getting any interest from other farmers?
There is a few other path networks that have been approved under the same funding scheme locally. But yeah, of course they're interested. They want to know why we're doing it and how we're doing it.
We do get questioned by farmers and why on earth you'd like to let people through your fields. But you have a right to roam in Scotland anyway, so at least if we can dedicate where it goes.
Have you walked the whole circle yet?
Oh yes, I love it. Every week we definitely go round the whole, and then we do... You can cut it up and do the whole circuit, or you can do little circuits, including the Fermarton Way, which is great.
It's getting better in Scotland, isn't it?
Yes.
It's improving. It is improving. Yeah, yeah. People are more aware that you've got to let people onto the ground. And this old farmer mentality of shutting off your land and not letting anyone in, that's...
It is a great advert for farming, though, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the best platform you can get, is to let people see what you're doing. Talk to them.
Helen and Fraser McIntosh.
It's great.
That's a really good model.
Yeah, and I was listening to Helen and Fraser talking. Goodness me, you're talking common sense.
Yeah.
A wee bit of money from government funding, seeding an interaction between farming and countryside folk, town folk, whatever.
Yeah.
Seeing what goes on. Nothing to hide here.
Yeah.
Come and walk around my farm. But at the same time, it does control... It's not controlling access. It's giving you the option. But 9 times out of 10, folk are going to take the path. And why wouldn't you?
Oh. Well, we're talking about paths. I've often wondered about how people put paths in. I was down by the Scottish Parliament in Edinburgh the other day, and that's a bizarre, bizarre setup. You know, you'll have a path which leads from the front door of the Parliament building to about 10 metres from where the pavement actually is, and then it just stops, and it's grass. So inevitably, you've got tarmac,
grass.
Then 10 metres of muddy grass, and then you're back to the pavement again. If people want to go that way, sure, there'll be some facility that pathmakers would say, right, fine, there's a desire line. That's where people actually want to go. Let's stick a path down there.
Yeah, is that sort of temptation to put the path in, that's it, done.
Yeah.
Whereas quite often that path's not going where people want it to go. But, you know, all put out of their elbow, the more paths, the better, and it keeps folk out of the way of traffic. And, you know, just for the fumes alone.
Yeah.
I was walking through Glasgow the other week, and it was just horrid.
Yeah.
Absolutely horrid. The buses belching fumes and the taxis pumping out smoke. It was just... It needs to change. We need to go electric or whatever, and we need more cycle paths, more walkways.
Sadly, that's all we've got time for on this week's Scotland Outdoors podcast. Feel free to rant on your own. You can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. From all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, and myself, Mark Stephen, him, Ewan McElraith, thanks for downloading us.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.